You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
So now we fast forward to 2004. I'm in Mexico. I am in the town of Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, a Pacific Coast state south of Sinaloa, Mazatlan, and north of Guadalajara, Jalisco, and Guerrero. I'm sitting there and I'm watching, for some reason, I'm watching the Democratic National Convention going on.
When is this? In the summer?
Say it was in August. Was it in August of 2004? It was definitely in the summer. I'm not sure the exact date of the convention, but I know it was in the summer of 2004.
Okay, I'll find out while you're talking. Go ahead.
Okay, but I do know that I'm in Mexico and I'm watching it on my TV screen. And like I said, I'm ready to fall off the couch because I see somebody that I had gone down on walking across the stage and being held as the next great hope of the Democratic Party.
Right. It was July 26th to the 29th at the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts.
But like I said, I know it was the summer, and I was in Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, and I was watching it. And it was just the funniest thing. But it doesn't faze me, I mean, other than just laughing my ass off and going, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. But like I said, people need to understand this is not something that is unusual for politicians or anyone for that matter.
Right.
I mean, people climb the corporate ladder and the political ladder in a whole bunch of different ways. And not all of them are the squeaky, clean, fine, upstanding citizens that people want to refer to themselves
right,
as
and, being. Right, and want to believe. Yeah, and of course, yeah. A lot of this was just revealed in those lawsuits against that actor, John Travolta.
Exactly.
Where Travolta said that Hollywood is controlled by a bunch of gay Jews, and you have to play the game to get along.
You're absolutely right. But unfortunately, people want to ignore the fact they want to try to promote Barack Obama and anyone associated with him for some reason as being this almighty, angel, godlike individual that just could not ever associate with the likes of Larry Sinclair. Well, he associated with the likes of Tony Rezgo for quite some time.
Right.
He associated with the likes of Stuart Levine, who arranged cocaine and gay sex-fueled parties in the Chicago gay community that he publicly sat in a courtroom and stated Barack Obama was a participant in on a regular basis. So people need to understand this is not just this godlike creature.
But I wanted to ask you, before you continued, you talked about how someone who's gay knows that if someone else is gay. Do you think he's gay or do you think he's bisexual? Or do you think he's heterosexual?
I'm glad you put it that way, or heterosexual, because you know how people in the gay community say, oh, well, you're born gay. It's not a choice. I tend to argue with that point. Yes, there are some people I truly believe are born gay that never made a conscious decision to be gay. It's just the way that they formed their opinions and their positions in life. However, I've also known in my lifetime some individuals who were not gay at all, but chose to engage in a gay lifestyle because they knew that emotionally it hurt their family or their parents or someone that they wanted to strike back at. If you ask me, is Barack Obama gay, bi, or hetero? The strict definition of bisexual, someone would say, would apply because there is claims that he has actually engaged in sexual activity with Michelle. If, in fact, he is the father of Malia and Sasha, which I think Malia definitely resembles him more than Michelle, then if you go by the strict definition, then yes, you could say he's bisexual. If you ask me emotionally what he himself really feels he is, I'd bet my life that Barack Obama is gay, who did a Jim McGreevy type thing and married for political purposes or for position and status in life. I think Michelle Obama was a door for him to get into the African-American community in Chicago, which is something that he had never been able to accomplish on his own. In fact, if you go back with history, you don't see Barack Obama ever even really talking about the fact that he's black unless it had some political payoff for him.
But he's gay?
I think he's gay. I do.
Okay. You're somewhere in Mexico, which probably you wouldn't want to be right now because of all the murders and beheadings that are happening.
Oh, please. That just makes life exciting in Mexico.
No thanks. I like my head. You see him on TV. This is almost 5 years has gone by. You haven't even thought of this guy.
Not even thought of him. But boy, I'm telling you, I have a memory that...
I could tell.
I have a memory that even scares my 96-year-old grandmother.
That's great, though. So almost 5 years goes by. You don't give this guy a second thought, a third thought, nothing. Zero zilch. It was just a good time, finished. All of a sudden, you see him on TV.
I start cracking up laughing is the first damn thing I do. Look, that's a badge of honor in Mexico when you can brag about the fact that you went down on a powerful politician or a connected individual. Come on. This was the new star of the Democratic Party. Are you kidding me? I was sitting there talking to some friends and neighbors, making light of the fact that now if this guy actually ever becomes somebody other than an Illinois senator, I mean, hey, I can chalk one up on my belt.
Right. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I want to focus on this for a minute, because I want the listeners to listen to what we're saying here and to form their own opinion, because this is a very important part of the story here.
You know, it is, because people say, oh, well, you're just trying to get some fame off. If I was looking for notoriety and fame and fortune off of this, I could have done a hell of a lot better with this back in 2004 when he was the rising star of the Democratic Party. In 2004, again, for me personally, it was something to laugh at, but it was insignificant. And people say, well, the voters of Illinois. My concern is not the voters of Illinois or some Chicago Senate district that voted for this guy. This guy doesn't make any decisions that affect me. It doesn't matter to me. It's up to the people in the Chicago district that voted for this guy to put him in the Illinois Senate to want to know who he is. And it wouldn't have mattered. I didn't even bring it up publicly until 2008. And people say, well, why in 2008? Because in 2008, you had people standing there. They were enamored with this guy because this guy was honest. He was transparent. He was above all of it. There was no secret. He was not going to hide anything. So again, we come into 2007 when I'm seeing these people say this on television. So I asked the campaign, and this is what people need to understand. I didn't just go public and say, oh, by the way, Barack Obama used crack cocaine while I went down on him. That's not how this came about, although a lot of people seem to think it is. I committed 6 months of my life in 2007 of trying to get Barack Obama and the Obama campaign in the 2008 presidential election to simply figure out how they wanted to correct publicly his contradictions about the extent of his drug use and the time frames of it. And it wasn't just me knowing that he was lying as far as knowing that he was using crack cocaine as recently as 1999, but if people would go back over his public statements and interviews that he gave during the 2008 campaign cycle about the extent of his drug use, you can pull together a good 15 different interviews where he told one media outlet that he never did anything other than marijuana, only to find him giving another interview 2 weeks later saying that, okay, he used cocaine once in a while when he could afford it, to another interview where he swears he's never used any drug of any kind since high school, and then given another one later contradicting that, saying that he used in college. So what people need to understand is this wasn't just me going public on YouTube saying, oh, by the way, I blew this guy while he was smoking crack pipe. I spent 6 months asking the campaign to do the right thing, which is a phrase that Barack Obama likes to use quite a bit lately, and simply correct publicly their statement, their position on what drugs he used and when he stopped using them.
What motivated you to do that, actually?
Seeing this young lady on television while I was in Delaware in September of 2007, telling, I think it was MSNBC or CNN, that she was solidly behind the Obama candidacy and would volunteer because he was this honest and open candidate, and he had been more honest about everything that he had done. He was honest about using drugs and what drugs, and no other candidate had ever done that. That's what motivated me to contact the campaign.
But you were motivated because it was a lie.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that was the only thing I ever asked the campaign to do, was simply, look, here's the facts. He was doing crack cocaine in 1999. One, that's not just marijuana. Two, that's many years after high school and even many more years after college. So if you're going to campaign saying that you are the most transparent, open, and honest candidate in American political history, then live up to that claim.
And when was this that you contacted the campaign?
September of 2007.
What transpired between when you saw him on TV and when you contacted the campaign? Did anything happen besides you talking to your Mexican buddies about how you knew this guy?
Nothing. Nothing at all. I knew he had announced in February of 07 that he was going to run. It was a good 6 months after he first announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination in 2008 that I even took the time to contact the campaign. It didn't matter to me when he announced that he was running. It only started mattering to me when all of these people were running around talking about Barack Obama was the next greatest thing since Christ was born. It was January of 2008 before I ever said anything publicly because I bent over backwards, no pun intended here, to give the campaign the opportunity to simply clarify the dates. This was never meant to try to ruin him as a person or as a candidate. It was simply meant to, okay, if everybody is going to say that you are these things, then you need to live up to being those things. It was never meant to be one of those situations where you call a campaign or a candidate and you tell them, look, I've got this on you. You better come clean or else. That wasn't it. What really pushed this issue to the point of me going public with a YouTube video on January 17th of 08 was the fact that I get a call in September shortly after contacting the Obama campaign. And that call comes from a guy that identifies himself as a Mr. Young. And he claims in this call that he is from the Obama for America campaign. It's what he says in this call that tells me right away that this is not someone with the campaign because it can't be. Because what he tells me, he asked me, he says, well, let me just get this straight. You want Barack Obama to come clean about his drug use. Why don't you want him to come clean about the sexual encounters? That right there tells me this isn't somebody from the campaign because I never once mentioned the sexual encounters with the campaign.
Right.
So now I'm really freaking out. But I go with this because I have no idea who this person is. I do know that the person has the same cell phone numbers that I left with the campaign. So from September of 07 through early December of 07, I continue to get these phone calls and these text messages from a guy that originally claimed to be with the Obama campaign that only later in these communications I find out is a gentleman by the name of Donald Young, who is an openly gay male, a school teacher in the Chicago School District, and the choir director of Obama's church, the one pastored by Reverend Jeremiah Wright. So in the course of this 4 months back and forth, it starts with, well, Senator Obama's looking into how they're going to make the statement, blah, 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 into becoming more personal and more open to where I'm being told that, okay, I'm not with the campaign. I'm actually a gay male that's been intimately and sexually involved with Barack Obama for years, who was asked to call you by Barack Obama and Jeremiah Wright to get as much information about who you've talked to about this in the media, all the way to the last communication telling me that any claims by the campaign claiming that they're going to come out and correct their drug use statement, not for me to hold my breath because it's not going to happen. Then these communications end. I don't even tie or connect this guy to being the Donald Young that's murdered in Chicago on December 23rd of 2007, just, what, 10, 12 days before the Iowa caucus. I don't even put two and two together until the spring of 2008. By that time, I put the YouTube video out. And I put the YouTube video out because I had been speaking with different reporters, with different media outlets, from the New York Post to the New York Times to the Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune. I had even contacted the Democratic National Committee, had contacted the law offices of Vice President Walter Mondale. I was doing everything in my power to get the campaign to simply come out and clean up their misinformation, their false statements about the drug use, and then moving forward with the campaign.
Okay.
I bent over backwards to make sure that I did not engage in any communications with any opponents of Barack Obama, whether Republican or Democrat. I made it a point I was not going to get involved in contacting anyone connected with or associated with the Clinton campaign, the Biden campaign, the Edwards campaign, none of them. And I tried everything in my power to get this man to be honest about nothing more than the drug use. But when it became evident to me that that was not going to happen, I had a decision to make. And that decision was, if I make a public statement, then I'm going to have to make that statement completely honestly about the extent of what I know and how I know it. And people said, well, why did you even have to mention the gay sex? You could have just left the sex out of it and the drug stuff would have been enough. And I'm like, no, it wouldn't. See, because I'm asking him to be honest. I'm asking him to do what he claims he is. How does that make me look if I come out and accuse him of doing drugs, but I don't tell the whole story from Jump Street, and then people come back and they go, well, how do you know this? And then I explain to them, well, I know it because I was in the back of a limo going down on him while he was doing it. Then you have the opportunity for people to come back and say, oh, well, you're a lying sack of you know what, because why now you're throwing the sex into it? You want to make this something that it's not. Why didn't you tell the truth from the beginning? See, I would put myself in the position of being Barack Obama all over again. If I didn't come out with the whole story from day one, as opposed to coming out with, well, I know you were using drugs in 1999, but I'm not going to tell you how I know that. And then come out 2 months later saying, well, I know it because I went down on you while you were doing it. And that's what people need to understand. It was never my intent to even have the sexual encounters come out. But I can't ask him to be honest about the extent of his drug use if I'm not willing to be honest about the whole story from the minute I go public and not just put out part of it only to come back later and add the rest of it and make myself look no different than Barack Obama.
So you went to the National Press Club with the story, right? When was that date?
I went to the National Press Club on June 18th of 2008 and held a press conference that the National Press Club themselves had no problem in taking the close to $9,000 that it cost us to rent the facility, to pay for their broadcast services, to videotape and archive the event. They began to be put under pressure by the far left, by Fire Dog Lake and the Obama camp and others, to where it turns out that everything we paid for, they basically ripped us off. I didn't realize it until after the fact, but they chose to make the room appear as if it could have been taking place anywhere in the world but the National Press Club. You have seen press conferences that have been held at the National Press Club. The podium has the National Press Club emblem stuck on the center of the podium, or else the wall behind the speaker says press.org, National Press Club, Washington, D.C.
Okay.
They made sure that absolutely nothing that could identify the place of this press conference was the National Press Club as far as in the background. If you watch that video, you would think that it could be any conference room in any hotel anywhere in the world.
You try to get your money back?
No, because what I wanted to do instead was I wanted to show that the National Press Club is not what they claim to be, because it turns out the National Press Club also engaged in working with Joe Biden's son, Bo Biden, in arranging for my arrest at the National Press Club, but it didn't go the way they had originally planned it. So when it did take place, they kind of stuck their foot in and didn't want it to become a scene. They had originally tried to plan it to where it would take place before the press conference even started.
Where is the National Press Club?
Is in Washington, D.C.
Right, and isn't Biden done? Isn't he in Delaware?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how could he arrest you?
Apparently, Joe Biden, or Bo Biden, excuse me, on February 4th or 5th of 2008, secured a sealed grand jury indictment against me, accusing me of theft of $1,000 or more. They claimed that they mailed notice of the indictment to me, only if you saw the court record, you would notice that the court record shows that they never mailed anything because they never put an address on anything. Apparently, this warrant was not in the NCIC system, which is the National Crime Information System that all law enforcement agencies use. It was in there, but only within a 250-mile radius. The
okay.
charge itself was brought about 17 days after my YouTube video went public on January 17th of 2008, shortly after his father, Joe Biden, dropped out of the 2008 Democratic nominating race. I had been in Washington, D.C. on May 31st of 2008 to attend the DNC's National Committee's Rules and Bylaw Committee meeting that took place at the Marriott Wardman, where they were arguing over how the DNC was counting delegates or designating delegates between Obama and Clinton out of Florida and Michigan, because the DNC had penalized the two of them and didn't allow their primary votes to count or something.
Right.
So it wasn't unusual known by Delaware or anyone else as far as where I was at or where I was living. In fact, at the time that they brought this sealed indictment, it was already public knowledge of my address in Duluth, Minnesota, because it was posted all over the internet by the likes of Joseph Sarah with WorldNet Daily and the former Court TV, I guess they call it now, smokinggun.com or something. My whereabouts was public knowledge at that point, so Delaware had no excuse for claiming that they didn't know where I was at or how to contact me, because that just wasn't the case. Apparently, the so-called charge, the National Press Club, got together with Washington, D.C. authorities, who decided to have me arrested at the press club and claim that I was arrested on a fugitive from justice warrant. Problem is there was never a fugitive from justice warrant that ever existed. In fact, when I was taken into custody on the 18th of June at the National Press Club, the authorities were asked to produce a copy of the warrant in which they were claiming they were placing me under arrest on, and they said they didn't have it. First, they said they had it downstairs in the garage in the car. So we walked down to the garage. Guess what? They still can't find it. They still don't have it. When they cuff me and take me into Metro DC's District 1 for processing, even once we get into the district station, they still cannot produce a copy of any warrant that they claim calls for my arrest as a fugitive from justice.
Okay.
It wasn't until the next day when I was taken before a U.S. magistrate in the D.C. court that D.C. officials actually filed their own charge for a warrant to arrest me as a fugitive from justice out of Delaware. So they had actually arrested me 24 hours before they had even brought charges on me.
Why not? They can make up the rules, right?
Exactly. They arrest me. I'm held in the D.C. jail for 6 days. I'm not allowed any phone calls. I'm not allowed to make contact with my attorney, who at the time was the strange kilt-wearing Montgomery Sibley. I was denied access to all of my medications, which I was prescribed to take, that were sitting in my hotel. The officer, or the U.S. Marshal, that actually processed me in at District 1 was kind enough to provide me with his cell phone long enough to call the hotel and let them know that I had been taken into custody so that they could secure my belongings in the hotel until I was able to make arrangements.
That was nice of them.
It really was. But for 6 days, I sat in a D.C. jail. I was never let out of the cell. I was never allowed to make phone calls to anyone. I was never allowed medication.
Isn't that against the law?
Well, technically it is, but look, they get away with doing what they do when they know that you don't have the resources to fight them back.
Right.
It was on the 23rd of June. I believe it was the 23rd of June. I would have to go back, but I'm almost positive. It was the 23rd of June that my cell door opened, and I was told that I was being transported to Delaware. A individual with the Delaware Attorney General's office had come to D.C. to transport me to Wilmington. On the drive, he told me that he did not know why D.C. had done what they had done, because the type of warrant that was out of Delaware is common in the District of Columbia, and the District of Columbia has never taken anyone into custody and held them for Delaware to come pick them up. In fact, the normal process would be that you go before a magistrate in D.C. and the magistrate gives you 24 hours to get on Amtrak and show up in Delaware to address the issue. And I had told him that I had actually attempted to make that request of the magistrate, but not only did he not want to hear me, the U.S. Marshals in that courtroom physically grabbed me and took me out of that courtroom, telling me I didn't have the right to even open my mouth to the judge.
Is this America we're talking about, or?
It wasn't just with me. Apparently, they did that with anyone. You had to let whatever attorney the court had put in that courtroom to speak for you, despite the fact that the attorney had never even spoken to you before you were taken into that courtroom. You didn't even know that that attorney was there to speak for you.
This is ridiculous.
So I was ordered held, and eventually they took me back in the courtroom, and the attorney that they had assigned asked the judge exactly what I wanted to ask her, which was, why can't I simply go out of here, get on Amtrak, and go to Wilmington and take care of this? But no. They wanted to make a whole big old stink. They wanted to use what Ben Smith and Politico had put out the day before on Politico's website. They wanted to claim that, no, he's a flight risk. He's lived under 14 different names and aliases, which is completely false, but people don't want to clarify. They want to put out what they get from an FBI printout.
Right.
Well, if you go by what the FBI says, I was born in 1963 and my birthday's in July, not in September.
Right.
And I'm actually 49 and not almost 51. The court said, oh no, he's got all these aliases, but yet they know that these aliases are nothing more than what individuals that have had interviews with police 20 years earlier referred to me as. And the funny thing is the majority of these so-called aliases are just different misspellings of my legal name at the time. So I sat there for 6 days, but the interesting thing is when I arrive in Wilmington, Delaware, I am in a holding cell for about 3 minutes. I appear before a judge by video conference, and I am immediately released on my own recognizance to return home to Minnesota with the understanding that I will have to come back to Delaware on certain dates to address these charges. Yeah. Long and the short of it, a little more than 2 months later, and some close to $30,000 broker, the state of Delaware dismisses the charges, claiming that they have no evidence to support them. And they only do this the day before Beau Biden's father accepts the DNC nomination as the VP choice.
At the press club,
mm-hmm.
And that was, what, June 18th, you said?
June 18th, 2008.
You went right from the press club to jail.
Yep. That's not even the best part of this. These people from Politico and the Obama supporters couldn't even be happy with that. They wanted to actually make a scene at the press club that they could put out on the internet and put on the nightly news, but it backfired. One of them actually called Metro Police and had two uniformed patrol officers go running into the press club asking for me and demanding that I turn around, that I'm going to jail, only to have the U.S. Marshals and the detectives from the Metro D.C. Police Department look at them and tell them to back off, that they have nothing to do with this, that they have this under control. So these two officers who are trying to make a big old scene in front of television and media cameras at the press club end up being told to exit the room with their tails between their legs.
Oh my God.
But it didn't stop the media from actually making reports that I was hauled off in handcuffs, which I wasn't. I walked out of that place with not a cuff on me.
How many members of the quote-unquote media were in that room?
I had originally reserved the Lissagor room, which could hold up to 40 people. That was already overbooked before we even got the press cards even printed or ready to print. We moved it to the Holman Lounge and had 120 chairs that were set up in the room itself, and I don't think there was two empty chairs in it. In fact, there were quite a few people that were standing up in the back because there were no chairs available.
Wow. Was it all the media, even the corrupt mainstream media, they were there also?
Oh, CBS, The New Republic, Politico, Reason, MSNBC, C-SPAN, CNN, they were all there, and not a single one of them wanted to report anything other than what Politico and Dave Weigel tried to do, which was try to make me look like a lunatic, and Huffington Post, of course, reporting it, talking about the most stupefying press conference in the world by the biggest circus clown in the media.
Yeah, it's amazing how they walk in lockstep. That never ceases to amaze me. And people say that we have an independent press. That's such a bunch of BS. There's no such thing as an independent press here. How could they ignore the stories that they ignore in unison? Incredible. It's mind-numbing when you think about it. When you actually think about all of the press outlets, the prominent, the mainstream media outlets in this country, and how they literally, they report on the same damn thing every day, day in and day out. So basically, they ignored you. You went to jail. You got out the day before Biden was announced as the VP candidate. They dismissed charges. Anything significant happened after that?
Well, what happened afterwards is it demonstrated the organization behind the efforts to silence me. The people who were adamant that I was going to go to jail for the rest of my life because Delaware could prove that I had counterfeited some money orders, which I didn't. They knew this. They knew this long before they ever even tried to bring an indictment. In fact, they had investigated all of it and had not determined that there were no criminal charges whatsoever that applied, only to wait and decide 2 months later when I go public about something on Obama and all of a sudden it's a crime. What significantly happened was after the dismissal, I managed to find postings of why people in the media were actually doing what we were just talking about, which was ignoring in lockstep. It turns out that you have these people behind the scenes that were making phone calls and sending emails to these media outlets and to their attorneys and to the reporters, flat out telling them that if they allowed Sinclair a venue, a platform, if they allowed me to speak or be broadcast on their airways, that they and their corporations would be sued for libel and slander. Problem is you can't sue for libel and slander if it's the truth. And you can't sue for libel and slander if you're a political public figure candidate telling the people of the country that they need to believe what you say.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter, Larry. They could tie you up in court. Look at how much money they cost you. They don't care about the truth. They just care about tying you up and costing you money, right?
Well, I just spent the last 2 years, from 2010 to February of 2012, fighting a $30 million defamation suit over my first book, only to prevail. But you're right. They succeeded in doing what they wanted to do. They cost Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon, myself, Ingram Content Group. They cost them enough money in having to respond and defend against it to the point to where they just decided, you know what, it's not worth it from a financial standpoint. I give Barnes & Noble credit. I give Amazon credit. I give Books A Million credit, because rather than settle and cave in and pay these people anything, they did fight it. They did prevail. I fought it. I prevailed. Unfortunately, I had to fight it a little bit longer because I didn't have the resources that these companies had. So I had to fight Washington, D.C.'s most powerful lobbying law firm, Patton Boggs, on my own. So I think it's a sweet victory to know that little old me can stand up against some of the most powerful attorneys in this country and win. But you're right. It's all about tying you up and costing you excessive amounts of money to the point to where people would rather just remain silent and just turn their head and act like they don't know nothing than to get involved in having to stand up for the truth anymore.
Right. The same thing happened to me with the New York Stock Exchange. They sued me and I didn't back down. I fought them and I did win. But again, it was somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory, as they call it. But I did prevail in court and I was able to speak my mind. And what I had to say was protected by the First Amendment. But this is what they do. It's a game that they play. And it's unfortunate that they abuse the law of the land, the Constitution, to get their own way. And these people should be brought up on charges. And I'm sorry that you went through what you went through and all this. But where does it stand here now with all this?
I am moving forward with Sinclair News and Ellis News Group. I'm moving forward with my radio program, Through the Mirror with Larry Sinclair. I can stand here today and say that the book Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder, is not defamatory. It's not libelous, and it has not been proven to be dishonest in any way, shape, or form, and it won't be. In fact, a U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. has determined that there is no indication whatsoever that the book is slanderous, libelous, or untrue in any way, shape, or form. The book is still in print. It's still available. Unfortunately, it's only available either directly through us or through individuals who have their own Amazon stores that order in bulk and sell over Amazon. It is available through Amazon Kindle if people want a Kindle version.
Mm-hmm.
I think after 4+ years of dealing with this and standing firm on what I have said and never backing down, I think people are starting to see the truth. I think people are willing to take a different look and look at it from a different perspective. I don't think everyone is automatically so quick to just dismiss me off as being some lunatic. Most of what I have said about Barack Obama has turned out to materialize as fact over the last 4+ years. So that's definitely comforting to know. I think at this point, and it's kind of what I told the people when I spoke at Freedom Palooza where I met you, this is no longer about me. And I want people to understand I never wanted this to be about me. And even today, I say it's not about me. What it's about is it's about the corruption. It's about the level of dishonesty that we have in the media, that we have in our elected officials. It is about the extent to which people and organizations will go to in attacking someone or trying to retaliate or bring about retribution against anyone who dares speak out against the establishment. I think it's interesting that MSNBC was one of the prime media sources over the last 4+ years that wanted to attack me on a personal level and portray me as being some character assassin. And yet, when they are sued and their Rachel Maddow personality is sued for libel and slander and defamation, they have used the very case brought against me and the very court rulings that rule in my favor favor to argue that they should be protected. I think it's just sweet irony that the very people who turned around and said that I was everything in the book but honest and credible are now using my very words to defend themselves against attack. So I think it's sweet to know that they have to resort to using the very defenses that I've used against them in defending against people that are going after them now. So.
Right. They have to use the truth. You know, these people are nothing but whores and traitors, as far as I'm concerned. Larry, I read something about you getting a polygraph. Did that happen? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, actually, I did. There was a polygraph that was done on February 22nd of 2008 that was arranged by the internet site WhiteHouse.com and its owners, Dan Parisi. It was done by Edward Gelb, and the site WhiteHouse.com reported that I had failed the polygraph. Since that time, there's been multiple claims and statements that I have failed multiple polygraph exams by multiple examiners. Even WhiteHouse.com attempted to claim that I had failed a polygraph and that I had failed based on multiple polygraph experts examining me. That's slightly misleading and dishonest. I did take a single polygraph test that was performed by a single polygraph examiner by the name of Edward Gelb. Mr. Gelb is famous for being known as the polygrapher to the stars, who am being chosen because there are reports that you can basically purchase the results that you want through Edward Gelb. But it seems that despite the claims that I failed, if you look at the video itself, which was only recently released, in fact, it was filed as an exhibit in that court case, in the defamation case last August 2011, and we have made the entire polygraph video available because it proves some things that we have said all along. One, did not fail the polygraph test, and contrary to a bunch of people's claims that when the computer says you passed and the examiner says you fail, that the examiner's interpretation is what is used. There is no such regulation or practice that says that's the case. In fact, if you take Dr. George Masick from the antipolygraph.org report that he did for us back in September of last year, you will find that one, Edward Gelb, you can see on videotape announcing that he thinks that I am a complete nutcase, a lying asshole, etc., etc. By making those claims himself, Edward Gelb violated the first rule of the ethics code for polygraph examiners, which says that if you hold any bias to the subject, you cannot perform a polygraph examination of that person. The fact that he displayed those biases during and after the polygraph exam, those should have been made public. They were hidden. But if you watch this video, you will find that Edward Gelb and Dan Parisi's assistant, Robert Braddock, who was recently arrested in Connecticut for conspiracy to conceal campaign contributions.
Nice.
Exactly. Eventually, the truth about people comes out. But if you watch the video, you will see Edward Gelb telling Robert Braddock that here's a result that the computer gave on me and whether I was lying or not that says I was being honest. But yet he dismissed it, telling Robert Braddock that, no, that can't be right because his blood pressure. Another thing you will see on the video that people don't understand is when you do polygraph exams, the blood pressure cup is applied to one arm, and the little electron thingies that are connected to the tip of the finger are done on the other hand. Edward Gelb connected both of them onto my left arm, whereby he could manipulate my blood pressure by the amount of pressure in the cup that he inflated. I tried to bring that up. He said that it didn't matter, but doctors tend to say that he's lying through his teeth on that one. But nonetheless, people say that I failed multiple polygraph tests. If you look at the report from Dr. Masick, if you watch the entire video, I think you will find that those claims that I failed multiple polygraphs are a lie. You will see that I only did one polygraph with one polygraph examiner, and based on the actual computer data from both of those, I passed. And I passed with flying colors.
Have you thought about doing another one?
You know, people have asked me, and I think about it when they ask, and then I think about it this way. When it was first announced that I was going to do a polygraph, the first thing everybody on the left, or that was supporting Obama, started saying was, oh, polygraphs don't mean shit. They're inadmissible in court. They're not proof of nothing, blah, blah, blah. The minute WhiteHouse.com decided they were going to claim that I lied, that the polygraph showed I was lying, all of a sudden those very same people that said, oh, polygraphs don't mean nothing, they don't prove nothing, all of a sudden they were the people going, well, look, he's lying, it proves it right here. So even if I did a polygraph today and the examiner was honest and it showed the same results that the computer analysis of the first one showed, which was I was telling the truth, people would still turn around, you would have people say, oh, this examiner's just lying, because so it won't prove anything to anyone. It'll just give people reason to question. And like I said, it's no longer about me. I think Barack Obama's own actions, his own words, and the actions of those that work with him and for him have more than proven my allegations to be substantiated without any doubt.
Right. And I'm very grateful that you have retained your memory. It's very impressive. I used to have a memory, perhaps not that good, but I did used to have one. But I'm glad you still have yours, because it came in handy, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book. And then after I read that, then it would be great to have you on again, and then we can go over the book and do a book review. Larry Sinclair of Sinclair News, LS News Group, and the author of Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder? That's a question mark. Larry, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners. It's a fascinating story. I never knew about it in detail. Thank you for taking the time out to really elaborate on it and let the listeners decide.
Dave, thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate it. It was interesting. It was nice to meet you at Freedom Palooza. And if you have any other questions, feel free to ask.